This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today as host, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And we thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today to learn all about all of the big news stories of the week and why they matter. For our panel today, here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Hi there.
Joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in the UK this week is Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, the big story this week happened in Sri Lanka, where a brutal terrorism strike left hundreds dead. To tell us about this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this was really one of the worst terrorist attacks that we've seen in recent years. It was timed for Easter Sunday. The group behind it was obviously very capable. It spent a long time planning this. So they had, right when people were arriving for mass, right when some of these churches were at the busiest that they would be for the entire year, they had a set of suicide bombers detonate themselves and destroy these churches. One church, there was around 100 people killed alone, and it was the scenes of destruction are just horrific, with the roof kind of caved in, dead bodies all over the floor, blood splattered all over the walls. At the same time, they also launched an attack on one of the oldest churches in Sri Lanka, in the capital there. So, most high-profile day, say, of the Christian calendar or the Catholic calendar, and then the most high-profile church in the capital. And then they also targeted luxury hotels, with some five-star hotels filled with Westerners, filled with people as well out to celebrate Easter by having a family brunch. And again, one of their very busy days with lots of tourism and travel going on at that time. Some massive, well-designed bombs and a lot of people killed. The total death toll now is on 369, and that's still rising with about, 500 wounded. And so just an absolutely massive attack, and one that has really reverberated around the world.
Yeah, this is just a shocking and a nauseating event that's happened there. Could you talk a little bit about who's behind it and how they may be connected to ISIS?
Right. So initially, the first group that became the government really focused on and said we're behind it, we're much more of a local group, one that had kind of carried out just some smaller scale attacks in Sri Lanka, where they'd, for example, desecrated some Buddhist statues before. That was the National Thrawhee Jamaatha group, and there's a related group within India. Now, the people are looking at this attack and saying, well, given the sophistication, given the planning that went into this, it was probably more than just some sophisticated group. A lot of analysts looked at this right away and basically said there are only a few terrorist groups that could carry something like this out. Hezbollah, but I think they were quickly ruled out. That's not really their kind of modus operandi. Islamic State, and Al-Qaeda. Given that Al-Qaeda has very recently said don't attack churches, that seems unlikely to be them, which put the spotlight immediately on the Islamic State. You had extremists from Syria, from Sri Lanka, travel to Syria to fight for the Islamic State. The Islamic State has been having a bit of a resurgence within the Philippines and Indonesia, so in that kind of East Asia general vicinity. And sure enough, just a few days later, the Islamic State came out and claimed responsibility for the attack, released a picture that they said showed the attackers standing in front of an Islamic State flag. There's been more released about those attackers today. For example, one of them studied in London and then went on to study in Australia as well. And what I think is really chilling about this attack that you've had here, Foreign Policy had an interview that they published this week, a couple of days ago, with Anne Speckhardt, who is the head of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. And I'll just read to you an excerpt from this interview. And they're talking about how many people went to the Islamic State. And then they've been largely defeated in Syria. A lot of those people have traveled back. They've traveled home. So this is the interview. The interviewer asked, so there's potentially tens of thousands of people right now walking around who are part of the Islamic State, but who are at large, basically. And then the expert there responded, in the world? Yes. So you've got tens of thousands of people that were so extreme that they saw ISIS beheading people on TV and they thought, yes, I want to go join those guys. That's what I want to be doing with my life. Not donate £10 or something like that. Not just stand and pray for them, but I am so dedicated to what they're doing. I'm going to leave my country. I'm going to leave my family. I'm going to potentially die. I'm going to completely upend my life. I'm going to travel to Syria, and I am going to be willing to give my life for Islamic State. That's how much I believe in it. And you've got tens of thousands of people that did that and have now traveled back home. And this interview just brought out that a lot of them were just let free. A lot of them, it's very hard to keep track of. And what we saw happening in Sri Lanka is the result. A coordinated attack on churches and luxury hotels that killed hundreds. And how many may have been involved in that? I think they've arrested 60 or 70 people. It's going up all the time. But then you think about, well, there's tens of thousands of those kind of people still at large. And there's the potential for a lot more Sri Lankans.
Yeah, that is a really chilling aspect of this whole thing. What can you tell us about the intelligence reports that came out several days before the attacks that warned basically that attacks like this were imminent? And why do you think those were ignored?
I think that gets to more some of the local politics in Sri Lanka. It looks like, I think it was India, it's come out now with the ones that released that report where they basically gave a warning and said, hey, guys, we think there's this group, the same group that I mentioned earlier, the National Tharawa Jamaatha. They're planning to carry out suicide attacks inside prominent churches. The trouble is, in Sri Lanka, you've had a bit of a conflict where the president tried to get rid of the prime minister and they failed. And so now they're not talking to each other and the prime minister is not invited to national security meetings, despite the fact that he's responsible for a lot of the national security things going on in that country. And so with that division at the heart of government, it seems like half of the government didn't tell the other half that there was this attack coming, and it didn't go forward. I mean, I think we'll see a lot more investigations as to why those warnings were ignored and what happened there. But that division seems to be at least a substantial part of it.
So some listeners might feel like this, it's sort of hard to see the big picture with this story. We're talking about a Buddhist majority country that we don't hear that much about very often, with it's got an Islamic minority and also a Christian minority, but I think it's 70% or something Buddhist. Could you help us see how this really fits into a much bigger kind of a clash of civilizations type story that you talked about this on the Wednesday Trumpet Hour, but maybe you could just give us kind of a nutshell version of that.
Right. What you've got is a global war between, where you've got some Islamic extremists attacking Christians, and you've got this in the form of terrorist attacks. That's what grabs the headlines when it happens so much. And obviously there've been attacks in France and Europe in recent years. But also you've got more, say, the low level attacks, the persecution of Christians in places like Pakistan, the terrorist groups such as Boko Haram that launch massive attacks against Christians, not in the West, but in Nigeria. You've got really Christians becoming one of the most persecuted minorities across the Middle East in a lot of these Muslim countries. And so what is happening here is you've got a deliberate attack from Islam at, say, the Christian civilization, Christianity, which is why you have the Islamic State constantly release propaganda about attacking the Roman Catholic Church, promising to attack Rome. Since Sri Lanka, when they celebrated their quote-unquote success in Sri Lanka, they released a big poster with a massive picture of the Pope and Donald Trump. That's the kind of the civilization that they're going after. And in their worldview, they want to provoke a European invasion into the Middle East, and going after, they see Christianity You know, they call Europeans the Crusaders. They see Christianity as a fundamental part of their identity. So they're trying to trigger a war with Christianity. And this is something that the Bible talks about. Daniel chapter 11, towards the end of that, it talks about a clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. And I got into more detail on this in my trumpet brief, Clash of Civilizations, Real or Racist, on Tuesday. But when you look at that prophecy, it all revolves around Jerusalem. And that in itself tells you that religion plays a strong, has a strong component in this clash. You know, why else would it revolve around Jerusalem? Yes, Jerusalem has some strategic importance, but you know, if you're trying to pick places that are, say, you might most want to conquer in the Middle East, aside from religious reasons, there are a whole lot of other places that would be very strategically important. Religion is the main reason that makes Jerusalem significant. And that scripture makes clear, you know, you have a king of the south, a radical Islam that really pushes at religion. And you see this with Iran, with the Al-Quds force, and they always talk about conquering Jerusalem, conquering Israel. And you see this in this prophecy because it says, well, Europe, when they move in there, they're going to move, you know, the seat of their religion to Jerusalem. It's a major part of it. So Daniel chapter 11 prophesies a religious clash. Other scriptures confirm that there's a religious clash. We've been saying for years this clash is coming. You can go all the way back, some of the earliest articles from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry in the Trumpet in the early, you know, 1991, 1992 were about the King of the South and this clash. And it's what we're seeing making our headlines more and more now as radical Islamist groups go out of their way to make exactly this clash happen.
Where would you send listeners who would like to understand more about that?
So I mentioned that article that just has some more of the details on this specific news event, Clash of Civilizations, Real or Racist. But really where you need to go is our book, The King of the South. It's amazing how much detail there is in that, you know, four or five verses, Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45, that describe what is going on in the Middle East right now. It's really the roadmap you need to understand these news events. And that booklet will unpack all of the information that's packed into those few verses, show you how what is happening in the Middle East was prophesied thousands of years ago. And then most importantly, it shows you where it is leading. You know, the Bible is very clear that these are events that Jesus Christ himself said to watch for, that are leading, you know, they're part of God's plan for world events. So that will help you understand what that plan is and where they're leading, so that you can follow the command that Christ himself issued in Matthew 24 to watch and pray and to watch these events.
We'll be sure to include a link to the King of the South booklet in the show notes for today's episode, and also one to Richard's very powerful trumpet brief, if you've not read that one yet. And we'll also link to yesterday's Trumpet Hour program, where Richard went into more detail about this very important story. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. And for the next story here, we'll go to Iran, where United States sanctions pressure on the ruling regime is intensifying. For this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, the high-pressure campaign that the United States is waging on Iran is really having an amazing effect. This past week, we saw an announcement from the State Department that no new waivers will be given to the oil sanctions that were imposed back in November. Basically, the Trump administration, when they pulled out the nuclear deal, said you have to stop accepting Iranian oil products. This makes up about half of their income, Iran's national income. So this was huge. But it gave exemptions at the time to seven or eight different countries and said that these countries specifically, for the next 6 months, until they diversify or divest away from Iranian oil, will be able to accept Iranian oil. Well, that 6 month elapses here in May 2nd, just a week or so away, and the United States announced that there would be no new exemptions that will be given. And so they expect all these nations to no longer buy Iranian oil. Right now, there's only about three that still do it. There's China that has about half of what Iran exports, about 500,000 barrels per day. They still buy. I think India is about 400,000, something like that, or 300, and then Turkey. And so they're all up in arms about this, and that has ramifications outside the scope I want to talk about, what China is going to do and what India are going to do, because they probably haven't been able to shore up other sources of oil just yet. So we'll see. But that also means that the money that Iran is going to be able to get by legitimate means that can't be sanctioned is shrinking. The avenues it can find money to strengthen the regime, to export terrorism, is shrinking because of the Trump administration's campaign. And in response to this decision, we had a couple of things take place this week. We had one where Zarif, the foreign minister, talked about how they might, if this happens, if the United States stops their oil from being able to be sold, which means their tankers would be stopped going out of the Persian Gulf, that they will shut down the Strait of Hormuz. This is a really critical area. I think it's about a 20 nautical mile stretch between Iran and Oman, out of which 30% of seaborne oil leaves. And it's not just Iran's oil that would affect. It would affect Saudi Arabia, Iraq's oil also, and UAE. So there's a number of nations that would affect. And this is a red line for the United States. There's two strike carrier groups headed to the Persian Gulf right now, massive show of military might to counter such an event. But we have the Iranians trying to find out a way of getting through this difficult patch because these sanctions are really starting to take hold.
So with the deployment of those carrier groups, it looks like the U.S. really takes this Iranian threat seriously and believes that they do have the might to close off Hormuz.
Yeah, well, this is something that they've said they're going to do for the past 40 years,
right?
That they were going to close the Strait of Hormuz, and they haven't successfully done it but for one or two days back in the late 80s. And the United States quickly countered that. However, there is a lot of the military might of the Iranian or the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps that runs all the naval activities inside the Persian Gulf. That's not run by the Iranian military. It's run by the IRGC that reports to the Ayatollah. They've been training for this event for years. Right now, they have 50 plus speedboats, attack boats. It might sound like nothing compared to a strike group, but the ability of these boats that are some of the fastest commercially made boats on water, they go up to about 65 nautical miles an hour, fully loaded with different weaponry. And they've been training different swarming tactics to try and approach destroyers and things without them being able to be hit because they're so small and agile. And then you've got early March, we had the Towards Jerusalem drone exercise in the Persian Gulf where there were 50 drones, again, with that are a small, agile, and able to attack different, you know, United States forces if that eventually comes. Now, nobody on the planet, even the Iranians, don't believe that they could close the strait for long, maybe a couple of days at max before the United States does eventually, you know, overcome them if they go that route. But seeing how volatile the oil market is right now, I think it's at the highest level it's been in over a year, just because of these sanctions coming on now, up by around $75 a barrel. It wouldn't take much to really send global jitters through the market that could really have adverse effects to the oil price and other economies. And so Iran isn't looking to do this. They just want it as an element that they have up their sleeve if their back is pushed against the wall where they need to act in a more robust way. We also had one other thing take place related to this, and that is the head of the IRGC. He was replaced. Jafari, he's been the head since 2007. He was meant to keep on leading till I think 2022 or 2021, but he was replaced this week in favor of a more extreme, brutish hardliner that is, if you've got somebody talking about the destruction of Israel outside the Quds Force leader Soleimani, this man, Hossein Salami, is he. And now he is the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And just think of that as a massive military that reports to the Ayatollah, Praetorian Guard basically that protects the Islamic regime, and it could defeat the Iranian military by its if it ever came to that. That was part of its original intent to create that, just in case the military regime decided to counter the Ayatollah. But they're a very powerful force, and this man used to be the head of their air force or airspace division, or the ballistic missile program that is shunned by the world as being illegal. Even Europe says this was headed by the Salami figure, and so this is a scene let's say a notice to the world that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is getting more aggressive in its posture towards the rest of the world, even though it feels the constraints of financial sanctions.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let listeners know what they could read to understand more about it?
Yeah, it's really interesting what we're going through right now. I spoke about this on the Trumpet daily radio show earlier this week, where we have this period in which it looks like Iran's power, though their rhetoric is increasing and though their positioning for moves across the Middle East, that they are being constrained temporarily by the Trump administration because of their reversal of the Obama administration's policies in the Middle East. And this is something that is only going to be temporary. We know that Iran, as informed by Bible prophecy, that they are a jihadi regime that believes in the conquering of the world. They will keep on pushing until they are stopped by actual force. There is no indication that the Trump administration wants to go to war with Iran. They don't want to do that. And so they'll probably try and, as much as they can through other means, try and squeeze the regime until it falls or it changes behavior. The Iranian regime is not going to change behavior. Don't be fooled by anything you read anywhere. Bible prophecy says it's not going to change. And those prophecies that detail our message in that regard are found in our editor-in-chief's book, The King of the South, that Richard mentioned before. And people should read that to understand what's going on with Iran.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, it was about 22 years ago now that Great Britain handed Hong Kong over to Chinese rule. And at that time, China promised the people of Hong Kong that for at least 50 years, they would be allowed to have a high degree of autonomy. But now, just 22 years in, China is dramatically tightening its grip on Hong Kong. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony.
A group of activists that led 79 days of protests in Hong Kong in 2014 was sentenced to prison terms of up to 16 months by a district court in Hong Kong on Wednesday. Now, these activists and their supporters, they'd just been demanding that they were demonstrating against China's tightening grip on the political system in Hong Kong. They were demonstrating against China's insistence on vetting candidates for the leader. And they wanted the pro-China leader to step down. They wanted more open elections. And the sentencing of these activists in Hong Kong might not seem so significant, but as an agent of the Human Rights Watch wrote in a statement to the New York Times on Wednesday, this development, quote, sends a chilling warning to all that there will be serious consequences for advocating for democracy, end quote. And obviously, that's a warning that's coming from China because, like you said, ever since China gained control of Hong Kong in 1997, it has just been asserting a lot more of its authority there. Lots of political opponents have been imprisoned because China wants to have that strong grip on Hong Kong. And yeah, the British handed it over to China in 1997. And as you indicated, China promised Hong Kong that it would retain its distinct identity and a high degree of autonomy under a principle called one country, two systems. But of course, that has been changing a lot in dramatic fashion, as this recent development indicates.
Yeah, this really shows that the whole one country, two systems model that China promised would be active for 50 years is basically dead. They're allowing Hong Kong to have a show of democracy, but it's only with pre-approved, you know, candidates that Beijing has signed off on. So it's really sad to see this happening in Hong Kong. Also, we're coming up now. We're just a few weeks away from the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, which was also a Chinese crackdown on pro-democracy protesters, but it was incredibly violent. And now we see that, you know, in Hong Kong, in Tibet, in Xinjiang, the Chinese Communist Party is using an incredibly heavy hand to just prolong and increase its power. What strikes me about all this is that it comes at a time when so many Western countries are inviting China in. They're saying, come on in here and build your Belt and Road. Come on in and install your 5G technology. Let your Huawei company integrate with all of our critical infrastructure. Do you think that this clampdown on Hong Kong, especially in light of what we see in Tibet and in Tiananmen Square and all that, should this make other countries realize that the Chinese Communist Party is dangerous and that inviting China in is maybe not a good idea?
It certainly should make countries more concerned about it. But then, unfortunately, this, for example, with Hong Kong, it's been 22 years now, and it's not that easy, unfortunately, for people to see how dramatic these events really are, how significant these events really are, and what a change it has been, and how much it shows China's aggression. And if Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article in 2006 titled "China is steering the world toward war." And in that article, he even talked about China gaining control of Hong Kong and made comments about how even that action in it, that act in itself boosted China's efforts to control the entire South China Sea. So these acts, they are just making China even more aggressive, and nations should not just allow this to happen. This is a prophetic trend, actually. The Bible talks about China's rise. We have a trend article about that, about why we watch China's rise as a superpower, and the Bible does prophesy about that. But there's another trend, too, that we can also talk about, and that is the decline of Britain.
Yeah, this story really shows both the decline of Britain there and also the rise of China all at once.
Yes, and what's more remarkable is that the Bible is super specific about God giving Britain places like Hong Kong. It's a sea gate, and the Bible talks about that back in Genesis 22 when God makes promises to Abraham saying he would give Abraham's descendants the gates of their enemies, and that's referring to these sea gates that God would bring to America and Britain, the descendants, the primary descendants of Abraham. So it's a prophecy. God gave these sea gates to the British, and we all know that from history. But now we're seeing the reverse of that. Those blessings are being taken away, and that too was prophesied. There is one prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 that mentions that. So we are seeing we are sort of seeing two trends playing out at the same time, the decline of Britain and the rise of an aggressive China.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. We'll be sure to include a link to "China is Steering the World Toward War" in the show notes for today's show, and that really shows the prophetic context of China's increasing aggression in a powerful way. For the next story, we'll go to Northern Ireland, where a wave of violence is quickly increasing. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Irish journalist Lyra McKee was shot and killed by a member of the New Irish Republican Army during a riot in Londonderry on April 18th. This is coming after a bit of a lull in violence in Ireland. You don't actually have to look back too many years, but you get back before, like especially in the 1980s, 1990s, there was a lot of violence. They even call it the time of troubles, as the Irish Republican Army was fighting and engaging in outright terrorism to get Northern Ireland back as part of a united Irish state, Ireland having gained independence from Great Britain in the 1920s, Northern Ireland being a predominantly Protestant state that's still part of the United Kingdom. Irish Republican Army was a group trying to use force and violence to take that territory. There was a bit of a lull after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, but now there's a group, the New Irish Republican Army, that's starting to engage in some of the tactics that you saw before that 1998 agreement. This particular riot was a New Irish Republican protest against the police. I think that's that they're saying what happened here is that one of the members was shooting at a police officer and ended up hitting a journalist. Some of the other far-left groups there have called on them to apologize. So under pressure, they finally did issue a statement that were like, well, we're sorry we killed the journalist. We were aiming for a police officer. Or I don't know if they outright admitted that they were trying to kill the police officer, but they said we were fighting the police and a journalist got caught in the crossfire. But yeah, this is just part of a trend that's starting to tick back up in the Northern Ireland.
What can you tell us about the prophetic significance of this kind of turmoil there?
Right. Well, any longtime listeners to this program know that from our we advertise our Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, a lot, showing that the United States and Britain are the descendants of ancient Israel. And there's many prophecies. One of the ones we go to most often is in Ezekiel 5, talking about increasing violence in these two nations in particular. Ezekiel 5 in verse 2 saying that he's giving instruction to Ezekiel to shave his head and burn like a third of the hair with fire and cut up a third with a sword and scatter a third to the wind. And then he explains that the fire, this third of fire is like a third of the people of America and Britain, or the third of people of Israel that are consumed by pestilence. Ezekiel 5 says that directly, but as our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Floyd, points out in his booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, that word pestilence just means destruction or death. One definition is to lay snares, to plot against, to destroy. So this pestilence could be a plague of violence or burning, not necessarily physical disease. It could be violence like rioting, things like you see in America, like some of the race riots engulfing big cities. Some of the things you see like in London with violence from Islamic extremists, and in Northern Ireland, so this violence coming from secessionist groups that are trying to use force and terrorism to take back or take territory away from the United Kingdom.
We'll make sure to have links to Mr. Armstrong's The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and also Mr. Fleury's Ezekiel's End Time Prophet article books, rather, in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are also on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with links to the literature that we're mentioning here. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information about these important stories. Coming up, we're going to talk about the ongoing power struggle in Libya, more anti-elitist attitudes revealed by Ukraine's landslide election, the latest in North Korea, and signs of a possible schism in the Catholic Church. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In Libya this week, the conflict and power struggle between the UN-backed government and the Libyan National Army continued. And for Western nations, the question of who is backing who is becoming complicated and divisive. To talk about this, we'll go again to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, I think we should stop calling it the UN-backed government, actually, since half the members of the UN Security Council now do not back that government. Mm. But you're right, that's what it is being still called. But France, the United States, that's the big news this week, and also Russia, do not back the government of national accord that was a virtual construct of the EU and the UN a couple of years ago to try and bring some stability and peace to Libya in the post-Gaddafi era. Now, that is based out of Tripoli. And then ever since that time, Gaddafi fell, you had the rise of a strongman. He's called Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar from the east. And he's been there for a number of years fighting Islamists in Benghazi, fighting against the Islamic State towards the center of Libya in Sirte, and moving his way slowly westward. Now, at the beginning, a few years ago, the United States was firmly, and even the French actually, were firmly on the side of the government of national accord, thinking that this government that they're creating that is representative, hopefully, of more people would give stability to Libya, ensure the flow of oil out of the central parts of Libya, and ensure the stoppage of migrants flowing into Europe. Let's bring some stability, work out their government. But the government of national accord has been unable largely to bring peace, stability, to the country. And so now you have a number of strong nations like Russia, France, and this week, as I'll get to, the United States, that are finally backing a military push of Haftar on Tripoli, on the Government of National Accord and the militias that are fighting for it. Now, 2 weeks ago, when Haftar started this mission or started this pushward eastward towards Tripoli, the government of the United States told him to stop. But then he received a phone call last week from the president of the United States himself, Mr. Donald Trump, saying basically, as is reported, he hasn't come out officially to say that they are supporting this with 100%, but it looks like it's true that they are backing this strongman rule over Libya. Now, it presents a whole lot of questions. Is the United States now for strongman rule, dictatorial rule in North Africa? That wouldn't be unsurprising, given that democracy has failed when it tries to be imposed on North Africans.
Right.
And so maybe he's
when Libya was under, you know, Muammar Gaddafi there, another strongman, it seemed to be stable and he seemed to mostly kind of contain the radical Islamist elements. So there is a model there that would show that support for a strongman could be justified.
Right, and that's what they say. That's what the strong leaders, like right now in Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, he is a strongman ruler that looks like he'll be in power till 2021, till something happens. He's got the rule of the army backing him, and he's said numerous times, you Westerners that want to promote democracy in my country, do not understand that if democracy, pure democracy takes hold, then we're going to have an Islamist country here in Egypt. And this is what he's been fighting against, Sisi, that is, towards the eastern border of Libya. And that's what Haftar, as an ally of Sisi, has been fighting for as well. And so now you are actually seeing decisions being made to accept this man's rule. But the thing is, his rule over the country is tenuous as well. Mm-hmm. He's been trying to take over Tripoli, but he has been pushed back by several militias there. Now, you're... The reason for this, I think, largely for the United States change of position has to do with Iran and oil prices right now, because we have like this question, as we're talking about in the first segment, whether the international oil supply is enough to prevent a spike if Iran is removed. You also have the crisis in Venezuela, which is taking a lot of their oil off the scene, off the market. And now you have Libya's oil that's being jeopardized because of the fighting before. Haftar now controls the oil crescent in central Libya. And so he is making sure that oil is still going to be able to be sent around the world. But added to this, I think, is the European angle, which is really interesting, because you have one element of Europe, one strong power being France, supporting, it seems, out with democracy, in with the strong man, as long as he's going to help us out from what our needs are in North Africa. And then you have the Italians that have been busy pursuing their own foreign policy with the Government of National Accord, preventing migrants from crossing into the Mediterranean. The whole reason that the migrant flows have stopped from North Africa through Libya into southern Italy is because the Italian foreign minister over the past year and a half has been buying off the militias in Libya that were actually transporting the refugees, the smugglers that were getting money in southern Libya, transporting these people from all over Africa and Syria to the coast and putting them on boats. That was being funded by militias in Libya. Italy comes down and through the Government of National Accord then pays the militias, and then migrants stop. And so that was their cure for the migrant crisis, and it seemed to be working. And now you have Haftar coming in and threatening to disrupt all of that. And so you have this case again, as Richard's brought out over the past couple of weeks, where you have dueling factions within Europe supporting different sides, promoting as a stalemate, it seems, of instability inside Libya. And so that a threatened Libya, an unstable Libya, is very dangerous for Europe's soft underbelly.
So if this is confirmed that the U.S. is now backing Haftar, do you think that it would be justified in throwing its support behind him?
Well, I don't want to get to whether it's justified or not. That's it's up for debate. Again, you have to just understand, like, the people that rule under these strongman leaders, they don't have the freedoms that we enjoy in the West. And I'm not even talking about you know, freedoms that go to an as exorbitant extreme. There's no freedom at the press. They do feel like they aren't able to express, you know, they're hurt for different religious minorities are threatened as well. And so I would say it's not really a nice place to live. But in terms of the better thing of two evils, it probably is a little bit better for the international scene to have somebody in power that could control the radical Islamist population that's bubbling in North Africa. And it exists. We know it exists. We've seen proof of radical Islamic regimes take over nations such as Egypt when democracy has its way. And so if France seems to think that, well, let's side with, and the United States seems to think, that let's side with the strong man for now, and hopefully they can prevent things getting out of hand in North Africa. And you can't really blame them for doing that. And again, this is an area that we know that Iran is going to be, and radical Islam is going to be, a powerful force in the future. And so here we have another instance where the United States president stepping in is kind of tapping the brakes, I would say, on the King of the South's rise in North Africa. But it's only a temporary pumping of the brakes, because if you have the United States and others supporting Haftar, those Islamic militias that weren't interested in fighting before against him will rise to the surface, because now their fight is a holy war and jihad against the West. It's not just against another rival leader in Africa.
Yeah, sounds like there are a lot of moving pieces here. We thank you for bringing us up to speed on that. Could you put that in the context of Bible prophecy and just explain what the Bible mentions about Libya specifically?
Well, Libya is mentioned in Daniel chapter 11, and I think it's verse 43 or verse 44, and it talks about it being a area of conflict between the King of the North, which is the European power led by Germany, and the King of the South, the radical Islamist camp. And when we see this bitter infighting or bitter fighting inside Libya, with everybody trying to get, like outside powers trying to get involved, such as the Europeans and such as the Iranians as well, and the Qataris, others that wants radical Islam to take control, we know that the scene is being set for that biblical prophecy to be fulfilled. And if people want to read more about that, they can read our editor-in-chief's book, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy.
Thanks very much for that, Brent. The global wave of protest populism and anti-elitist attitudes is still going strong. And this week it reached new heights in Ukraine, where they elected a comedian outsider as president. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Richard.
Yes, it really was a landslide result in Ukraine's presidential elections over the weekend. The winner was Volodymyr Zelensky. He, like you said, he's a comedian. He is actually the president already in a Ukrainian comedy show. Mm. So in this comedy show, he plays a teacher who he gives this kind of a rant about how corrupt all the politicians are. Somebody secretly records it, sticks it on YouTube, it goes viral, and he basically accidentally finds himself president. And it's a comedy where you've got this well-intentioned but naive guy running the country. And you know, the Russians saw that, and they saw someone running who was completely new, and they went for him in droves. It is kind of unusual to see. I did go and I watched a few clips. Servant of the People is the name of the program he's on. It's in Ukrainian, but auto translates pretty good these days. You know, for example, one of the clips in there, or one of the episodes in the film, is he gets a phone call from Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel tells him, congratulations, we've decided we're going to admit your country into the European Union. You know, he jumps up and down, oh, thank you so much. Ukraine has been waiting for this for so long. And Ms. Merkel says, wait, sorry, Ukraine? Oh, no. I meant to invite Montenegro. I thought you were the Montenegrin guy. My bad. And you know, now, this week, he was fielding actual telephone calls from Ms. Merkel. Angela Merkel called him to congratulate him. Another clip, incidentally, shows him machine gunning the entire Ukrainian parliament, wow. Which I think that you would have a guy that, at least in fiction, machine guns the entire Ukrainian parliament, gets elected prime minister, shows you a bit of the mood over the country right now.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the regime. They just voted. You know, they had quite a few different choices in this election. And they said, you know what, let's just vote for the guy who has never done anything in politics before. You know, we just want someone new. We want someone different. And Ukraine has a lot of special circumstances. You know, it's the only European country actively engaged in war right now, because Russia pretends that it's not. It's got all of the country, all of the problems that come with Russia chopping off a big chunk of its territory. It's got economic problems. Corruption there is generally much worse than it is in the rest of Europe, especially in the West. So, yes, a lot of unique circumstances, but still, this is a powerful symbol of the desire for change that's sweeping all across Europe. You know, you had a poll published just in the last few days that showed the Alternative for Deutschland was the number one most popular political party in East Germany. You know, this upstart, even far-right party, where leaders have talked about how, you know, the Nazis are not so bad. We need to stop memorializing and stop commiserating over the Holocaust. We need to be proud of Germany's history and Germany's achievements, even being proud of Germany's achievements in World War II. You know, that party is now the most popular party in East Germany. You had big demonstrations in France over the weekend with the Yellow Vest protests. You've got Italy heading for a divided election because you've got the far right participating as a real contender for the first time in their democratic history. So, you know, it's a powerful symbol of this entire trend across Europe where people are choosing upstarts and outsiders and even comedians over regular politicians.
Yeah, it seems like foreign onlookers are sort of caught between amazement and amusement, maybe, with Zelensky. But Ukrainians, though, seem to be divided between seeing him as, half see him as a real savior, or possibly more than half, and the others dismiss him as a phony. What's your read on his substance?
Well, firstly, I think that's a really interesting point to watch, this politicians as a savior kind of a view. I mean, you see this even in the United States, but even, you know, when Petro Poroshenko was elected, the previous president, he was kind of elected as a landslide with lots of people looking on him as a savior. You see, even with the way that the media covers the U.S. presidential election, you know, you had Beto O'Rourke was kind of the messianic figure, and now they've moved on to, what was it, Mayor whatever, the homosexual guy, where he's now being hailed everywhere as the savior. I think it's almost like Caesar in the Roman Republic. You have corrupt politicians, people often look for one man to be the savior, to come in and fix it. And yeah, you see that in Zelensky. I mean, I think in terms of can he actually do it, he does have some interesting things in his favor here. He received the majority of the vote, not just from the Ukrainian speakers, but also from the Russian speakers. And he himself speaks Russian. So there's some indication that, okay, well, maybe he can heal some of the divides. There are also some indications that he might still be in the pocket of some of the big oligarchs. So, you know, maybe not. Maybe he will turn out to be just as corrupt. He didn't really talk much about politics and policies and, you know, this is specifically what I'm going to do, who I'm going to hire. So he's elected now and nobody really sees what's going to happen. You've seen Russia go on the offensive just about as soon as he's elected. They stepped up their policy just in the last few days where they give out Russian passports to Russian citizens living in Donetsk and in Eastern Russia there, where, you know, this is the way Russia works. They hand out these passports and then they get involved saying, oh, we're just protecting Russian citizens. Deutsche Welle, their headline on that yesterday, Ukraine furious after Russia speeds up passport process in eastern Ukraine. So there are real challenges. We haven't seen much in terms of ability demonstrated from Zelensky. Maybe he's some kind of political genius, but it seems unlikely, and it seems unlikely that he will fix the problems there. But still, this idea to look to some kind of messiah figure to come fix all of your problems is, I think, a really interesting trend.
Yeah, so, and it's also just more evidence that across the continent, Europeans are hungry for change. Could you give us a very brief synopsis of how that's prophetically significant?
Yeah, I mean, this idea of looking for radical change and looking to one man to embody that radical change is something that is absolutely in line with Bible prophecy. This is one of the big things that we've been focusing on for years in Europe, is the rise of a strong man leading Europe. You know, I went back to mentioning some of those early Trumpet editions from the early 90s, and I think it was in one of the first few editions of the magazine, at least in terms of ones we've still got in the archives, that Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had an article talking about, well, watch for this strong man in Europe. Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 tell us there's going to be a strong leader there. Revelation 17 talks about 10 nations submitting to a strong leader. It talks about 10 kings, 10 strong men themselves, who aren't, you know, they're kings. They're not presidents. They're not democratic. So the Bible tells us, well, you're going to have a revolution in European politics and you're going to have the rise of a strong man. What do we see in European politics right now? Massive turmoil. Exactly the kind of scenario you would need for completely different sets of politics to come in. And all around the world, you see this desire to look to a strong man to fix those problems. So, yeah, it's a really important trend to keep watching. We have a book on this, or a booklet on the subject, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. You can read that, and that will show you what these prophecies are, why they apply to modern Germany, and help you watch this vital trend emerge in Europe.
Well, thanks for filling us in on that, Richard. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Russia today. He's there in Vladivostok on the East Coast, meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is Kim's first known visit to Russia and his first meeting with Putin. And in the lead up to this historic trip, there was a troubling development in North Korea that could indicate some of the ambitions that Russia and North Korea have. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony.
Yes, last week we talked about North Korea testing some weapon of some sort just before this meeting between Kim and Putin. And there was also news about North Korea's nuclear reprocessing activity, which seemed to indicate that they were maybe trying to kickstart its nuclear weapons program again. And again, it was all happening prior to this meeting, so that just makes it a lot more interesting. And like you said, this is the first time Kim is visiting Russia, and it's the first time he's meeting Vladimir Putin, so it's quite unprecedented for him. And the two leaders, they met for more than 3 hours, and following the meeting, the North Korean leader said, "We are very much willing to take the Korean-Russian ties to a new higher level." Here's what some people have been saying about this meeting. The New York Times said that the visit was part of North Korea's leader's efforts to fend off American pressure to give up his nuclear weapons arsenal. Stratfor also said something quite similar. It said, thanks to its decades-long ties with North Korea, Russia has become an economic and diplomatic lifeline for the oft-embattled regime. While sanctions against North Korea, as well as Russia's economic malaise, will limit what Moscow can tangibly provide to Pyongyang, the meeting will highlight the host's role as a potential counterbalance to both China and the United States, and a possible facilitator in the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Still another source, it said that the true purpose of Kim's visit to Russia was a chance to leave himself some wiggle room when talks with the United States resume, and to use Russia as the boogeyman if United States President Donald Trump goes too far with his threats. So it appears that we are seeing a situation similar to what happened in Syria, where Russia, despite its limited resources comparatively speaking, steps into Syria, to the Middle East, and takes on the role of lead negotiator. And it seems like that's something that Moscow is looking for. Again, it doesn't compare to China in terms of the help it has been providing to North Korea, but in spite of all of that, it is still willing to get more involved. Stratfor even says that China might even not provide as much to North Korea because of these ongoing trade talks with the United States. So Moscow is really seeing itself in a good position to insert itself, to get more involved. It can help North Korea in a variety of ways, including continuing to employ North Koreans in Russia, which helps the the economy there, and even possibly providing an outlet for some of the goods that North Korea cannot trade legally. So we are seeing Russia working very hard to get more involved in North Korea. There is a possibility that even Russia could even facilitate North Korea strengthening its ties even with South Korea. So it's a very interesting development, especially considering what Bible prophecy says about that region, how that region led by China and Russia will unify and lead this massive army that's prophesied in Revelation. So what we're seeing right now is more developments toward that that outcome.
We'll be sure to include a link to our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which really shows that China and Russia are the regional behemoths there and the real powers to watch in Asia. Thanks very much for that, Anthony. Well, we haven't heard much over the last few years from Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who resigned as Pope about 6 years ago. He had stayed pretty quiet in the time since then, especially as far as commenting on his successor, Pope Francis. But now that has changed, and his silence is broken. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, it's a strange situation to have two living popes. It's the first time it's actually happened in over 600 years. And so, as you mentioned, Benedict had been keeping pretty quiet, trying not to throw a monkey wrench in his successor's business. But then on April 10th, published a 6,000-word letter giving his view on the sex abuse crisis that's rocked the Roman Catholic Church, and attributing that primarily to the sexual revolution that happened in the 1960s, rubbing off on the church, specifically these groups of homosexuals that have worked their way into Catholic seminaries, saying that there's just rampant homosexuality within the Catholic priesthood that was contributing to this this crisis of male priests abusing young boys, which makes Pope Francis, he didn't directly criticize Pope Francis. I don't know if he even particularly meant to criticize Pope Francis, but it definitely kind of undermines his position, where Pope Francis has been kind of trying to not address this crisis much at all, even saying at one point that those who accuse the Catholic Church of, who constantly accuse the Catholic Church, are friends and cousins of the devil. And had been definitely more lenient than Pope Benedict was at allowing homosexuals into the priesthood as long as they said they weren't active. And so the followers, or like I guess the adherents of each pope, probably have more division between them than the two popes actually do. But it is creating a great crisis in Catholicism, as you've got this traditionalist wing of the church and this progressive wing of the church at odds with each other, leading many analysts even talk of schism within the Catholic world. That's happened a few times throughout history, but not happening this time. But here at the Trumpet, we're making the prediction that we can take the position that there will be no major debilitating schism in the Roman Catholic Church. Bible prophecy indicates that there'll be a more or less united church that rises up and even absorbs independent Protestant churches back into the fold as it rises up to lead Europe. Now, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's not going to be some breakaway groups or anything like that that come off of it, but you're not seeing something on the scale of like the Eastern Orthodox schism. As a matter of fact, the Bible is indicating that some of those Eastern Orthodox groups will probably come back into the Roman Catholic Church as this emerges as the spiritual authority over Europe. And I have an article online right now entitled, Will Pope Francis Cause a Schism in the Catholic Church? That gives some more detail on that prophetic trend.
Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please send any questions or comments about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks also to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And since you didn't get to hear Mr. Hilliker on the show today, we'll leave you with some of his words about the Hubble Space Telescope, which was placed into orbit this week back in 1990. He said, From the Hubble, we have seen supernovas, galaxies in their early stages, and massive stars collapsing, comets striking planets, and births of stars. This telescope is helping us coax the cosmos into revealing its mysteries. And the more we learn, the stronger the evidence becomes of an absolutely remarkable truth. There is an author of the cosmos, and he intended for us to be able to study the stars to help us come to know him. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.